From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on Iraq politics and the militant insurgency, ceasefire holding in the Gaza conflict, Nigeria, another case of Ebola there, plus the passing of a comic genius. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Iraqi President Fuad Masum named veteran Shiite politician Haider Abadi to form a new government on Monday after a lengthy tug of war with outgoing Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, who refused to step aside. Soon after the nomination, however, Mr. Maliki appeared on TV with other members of his political bloc, insisting that they would not accept the nomination and that Mr. Maliki remain their choice for Prime Minister. The story now from Edward Uranian in the VOA Middle East Bureau.
The nomination of Haider al-Abadi to form the new Iraqi government was a moment Iraqis had been anticipating for weeks. The presence of key Shiite leaders at the ceremony inside Baghdad's Green Zone indicated strong support from other Shiites.
43 from 53.
The refusal by part of Mr. Maliki's political coalition to accept the nomination, however, left political commentators guessing exactly what would happen in the hours to come. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And here in the U.S., on Monday, President Obama spoke with reporters about the situation in Iraq, where the militants of the group calling itself the Islamic State have been taking control of various parts of the country, and most recently forcing thousands of Christians and Yazidis to flee their homes, hide in the mountains of the northwestern Iraq, trying to escape the militants' onslaught. Mr. Obama began his Monday comments by talking about U.S. airstrikes against militant positions.
Over the past few days, American forces have successfully conducted targeted airstrikes to prevent terrorist forces from advancing on the city of Erbil and to protect American civilians there. Kurdish forces on the ground continue to defend their city, and we've stepped up military advice and assistance to Iraqi and Kurdish forces as they wage the fight against ISIL. At the same time, we've continued our daily humanitarian efforts to provide life-saving assistance to the men, women, and children stranded on Mount Sinjar, and deployed a USAID disaster assistance response team to help. Some have begun to escape their perch on that mountain, and we're working with international partners to develop options to bring them to safety. I want to thank in particular the United Kingdom, France, and other countries working with us to provide much needed assistance to the Iraqi people. And meanwhile, our aircraft remain positioned to strike any terrorist forces around the mountain who threaten the safety of these families. This advances the limited military objectives we've outlined in Iraq: protecting American citizens, providing advice and assistance to Iraqi forces as they battle these terrorists, and joining with international partners to provide humanitarian aid. But as I said when I authorized these operations, there is no American military solution to the larger crisis in Iraq. The only lasting solution is for Iraqis to come together and form an inclusive government, one that represents the legitimate interests of all Iraqis, and one that can unify the country's fight against ISIL. Today, Iraq took a promising step forward in this critical effort. Last month, the Iraqi people named a new president. Today, President Masum named a new prime minister designate, Dr. Haider al-Abadi. Under the Iraqi constitution, this is an important step towards forming a new government that can unite Iraq's different communities. Earlier today, Vice President Biden and I called Dr. Abadi to congratulate him and to urge him to form a new cabinet as quickly as possible, one that's inclusive of all Iraqis and one that represents all Iraqis. I pledged our support to him, as well as to President Masum and Speaker Jaburi, as they work together to form this government. Meanwhile, I urge all Iraqi political leaders to work peacefully through the political process in the days ahead. And this new Iraqi leadership has a difficult task. It has to regain the confidence of its citizens by governing inclusively and by taking steps to demonstrate its resolve. The United States stands ready to support a government that addresses the needs and grievances of all Iraqi people. We're also ready to work with other countries in the region to deal with the humanitarian crises and counterterrorism challenge in Iraq. Mobilizing that support will be easier once this new government is in place. And these have been difficult days in Iraq, a country that's faced so many challenges in its recent history. And I'm sure that there will be difficult days ahead. But just as the United States will remain vigilant against the threat posed to our people by ISIL, we stand ready to partner with Iraq in its fight against these terrorist forces. Without question, that effort will be advanced if Iraqis continue to build on today's progress and come together to support a new and inclusive government.
That was President Obama speaking on Monday. UN World Food Program bringing food to more than 700,000 people in Gaza who are not already receiving help from other programs. WFP took advantage of the 72-hour ceasefire that started on Sunday to begin delivery of one-time food parcels to 143,000 families on Monday. Also Monday, Israel and the Palestinians started new talks in Cairo aimed at crafting a permanent truce to end fighting in Gaza, which has left more than 2,000 people dead. We get more now from Robert Berger in the VOA Jerusalem Bureau.
Palestinians fired rocket barrages at Israel right before the ceasefire went into effect at midnight, but then the guns fell silent. The truce cleared the way for an Israeli delegation to return to Cairo for indirect talks with Hamas on a long-term ceasefire. The negotiations, which are mediated by Egypt, broke down last week after a previous 72-hour truce expired with a new round of fighting. Both sides remain entrenched in their positions, and the gaps are wide. Israel wants the demilitarization of Gaza, while Hamas is insisting that Israel and Egypt lift a crippling blockade on the territory. While Israel is willing to ease the blockade, it will not allow the free flow of goods that Hamas could use for military purposes. Israeli Cabinet Minister Tzipi Livni said any import of cement to rebuild Gaza must be under international supervision to prevent Hamas from rebuilding a network of tunnels that can be used for terrorist infiltrations into Israel. She said money and material entering Gaza must benefit the Palestinian people and not Hamas. Livni told Israel Radio that Hamas must lose this war and it will not be allowed to turn terrorist aggression into a victory. Hamas, on the other hand, needs an achievement to show its people for all the death and destruction wreaked on Gaza, and lifting the blockade would provide just that. Hamas says the 7-year siege is illegal and immoral, and there will be no agreement unless it is removed. Senior Hamas official Musa Abu Marzouk said it is impossible to return to the situation before the conflict, in which Gaza was a big open-air prison. One emerging compromise is that the internationally backed Palestinian Authority, which rules the West Bank, will supervise the Gaza border crossings along with European officials. Despite the obstacles in negotiations, the lull in fighting is providing battered Gaza with some desperately needed humanitarian relief. Hundreds of trucks have crossed the border from Israel carrying food, water, medicine, and supplies. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Nigerian officials said Monday a new Ebola case had been diagnosed, that is, widening the circle of people who have come into contact with the disease. Heather Murdoch reports from Abuja that Nigeria now has had 10 confirmed cases and 177 people known to have had contact with sick patients who are being monitored for signs of the disease.
Every time an Ebola case is diagnosed, the containment clock is reset. If no one that came into contact with the sick person gets sick within 21 days, chances are no one will. Since a Liberian-American financial consultant flew into Lagos from Liberia about 3 weeks ago, the number of new cases has slowly grown, increasing the number of people that may have been exposed. Over the weekend, another patient was diagnosed in apparent connection with the Liberian-American man, says Nigerian Minister of Health, Onabuchi Chukwu.
He was one of the nurses who had primary contact, and when he got ill, we then brought her into isolation, and we just tested her over the weekend, and she tested positive.
Ebola has killed nearly 1,000 people since the outbreak began early this year, with all but two deaths in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. Reports that experimental drugs have appeared to have been successful in treating American and European health workers and missionaries that contracted the disease in West Africa have prompted many Nigerians to demand access to the drugs in case it spreads further. Minister Chukwu.
Nigeria is actually, as of now, reaching out to various laboratories, various governments, including the U.S. state governments, to see how some of these untried but drugs and vaccines that seem to hold out some hope could also be deployed in Nigeria. We're in touch.
The World Health Organization says it expects a vaccine to be developed by 2015, but currently there is no known cure. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan Friday pledged $11.7 million to try to stop the spread in Nigeria and $3.5 million to help other countries fight off the disease. Meanwhile, Nigerian officials continue a massive communications campaign to squash the equally massive rumor mill. Local news reports illnesses all over the country from people drinking too much salt water or eating too much of certain fruits, falsely believing it will prevent Ebola. Officials speak publicly daily about how to keep from getting Ebola, which is transmitted through contact with bodily fluids like blood, urine, or sweat. It cannot be transmitted through air, the minister says, but
if you are in close contact and someone who is suffering from it is sneezing or coughing into your face, you could also get it because the droplets will touch you. So that close contact makes it, that's why some people say it's not airborne, that you need that close contact.
He urges people to wash their hands frequently, especially after touching another person, and says so far in Nigeria, the disease has not spread out of Lagos, a megacity of 21 million people, which is often called the heartbeat of the Nigerian economy. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
World Health Organization says the death toll from the Ebola outbreak has now surpassed 1,000, and the number of confirmed cases has surpassed 1,800. The bulk of those cases are in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. And in Malawi, health authorities say they are taking measures to prevent the spread of the Ebola virus into their country with airport screenings of international passengers. But critics say this is not enough, as we hear from Lamek Messina in Blantyre.
Minister of Health authorities say the airport screenings are currently done to those passengers from West African countries most hit by Ebola virus, Guinea, Liberia, Nigeria, and Sierra Leone. The government has also set up quarantine centers at the country's two airports, Kamuzu International Airport in the capital, Lilongwe, and Chilega Airport in the commercial capital, Blantyre, for those who may have contracted the virus. Charles Mwansambo is the Director of Health Services in the Ministry of Health. He told journalists in Lilongwe that there is no need for Malawians to panic because chances for them getting infected are minimal.
I need to reassure members of the public not to panic because Ebola is spread by direct contact with bodily fluids. And bodily fluids here, we're talking about blood, talking about saliva, we're talking about urine. And the chances of Malawians going to West Africa and getting in touch with these bodily fluids are very minimal.
But the chairperson of Malawi Experimental Committee on Health, Juliana Lunguzi, told VOA that what Mwansambo said is unrealistic. She said there is no logic in telling people not to panic when the situation on the ground shows that the government is doing nothing to prevent the outbreak.
To say, don't panic, anything can happen. And people go to places like Nigeria, especially to TB Joshua, where they are looking for healing, and here Ebola is one of the diseases. So we are saying, we'd rather panic. Let a certain group be panicking right now by giving us a response that somebody is putting something together so that you can even see the redness somewhere.
She says the message contained in the only press release the government has so far issued on Ebola virus does not benefit many Malawians because it's in English, a language many Malawians do not understand. Lungos, who is a nurse by profession, said her committee will soon summon government authorities to explain their readiness in terms of medical equipment for combating the possible spread of Ebola into the country.
We know hospitals are already have a serious short supply of equipment and supplies. Currently, we are yet to hear if there's anything. We have called several hospitals. Everybody says this, we don't have equipment, anything ready in readiness for the Ebola. So we want to make sure that we meet and let the government tell us exactly what they have done.
Jonathan Gama is the chairperson for Human Resources for Health, a coalition of health professionals in Malawi. He says Malawi is not in any way ready to contain the virus. Gama says inadequate medical equipment, protective wear, and orientation for health workers as among the signs of the country's unpreparedness.
What we are suggesting that there should be capacity building of the health workers. The health workers should be trained. And after training the health workers, they should also procurement of resources as Ebola demands. So that when Ebola instances appear in Malawi, we should not be taken by surprise.
But Minister of Health officials insist that something is being done to prevent the spread of the virus. Its spokesperson, Henry Chimbali, told reporters the ministry is working on a budget that would fund efforts to contain the deadly disease. The World Health Organization says the virus is a global health problem. To contain the spread, some African countries, including Guinea and Zambia, have closed their borders with Western African countries hardest hit by the Ebola virus. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
U.S. Missionary Medical Group, SIMI, that is, International, says the families of three of its Liberia-based missionaries, including the husband of nurse Nancy Reibol, who is being treated for Ebola in the U.S. city of Atlanta, Georgia, are back in the U.S. Bruce Johnson is president of SIM. He spoke with reporters at the group's headquarters in Charlotte, North Carolina, Monday.
Spent time with all three this morning. They're healthy. They were healthy when they got on the airplane in Monrovia, Liberia. They were healthy and checked by a nurse from the county before they deplaned at Charlotte Douglas Airport. And they've been checking their health this morning. All are healthy.
Johnson said the family members will be quarantined to ensure that they did not contract Ebola while they were in Liberia. SIM operates a hospital in Monrovia where many Ebola patients are being treated. Reibol contracted the disease there, as did Dr. Kent Brantley of the medical aid group Samaritan's Purse. He also is being treated at Emory University Hospital in Atlanta. Doctors say both Reibol and Brantley are steadily improving. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is sharply criticizing South Sudan's warring factions after they missed a key deadline to form a transitional government. He said it is an insult to the country's citizens. Under an agreement reached in May, South Sudanese President Salva Kiir and his longtime political rival Riek Machar promised to establish a unity government by August 10th. Fighting between forces loyal to the two men has left at least 10,000 people dead since December.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With the landing of
civilians. And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
With all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Veteran U.S. actor-comedian Robin Williams was found dead Monday at his home in Northern California, the victim of an apparent suicide. He was 63. Williams was a stand-up comedian when he made his television debut in 1978. He moved into the motion pictures and won acclaim for numerous film roles, including Good Will Hunting, for which he won an Oscar as Best Supporting Actor. Reporters asked him if that was the movie of all of his work at that point for which he wanted to win an Academy Award.
Oh, yes, this one, yes. Uh-huh. The other ones were just foreplay. This is Wild Night. It's insane. I'm still like this. I was in there taking photos. I was like, hey, nice to be here. I have to change pants, but you'll understand that later. No, it is. It's extraordinary. I'm very proud.
Williams was also known for his starring roles in the film Mrs. Doubtfire, Good Morning Vietnam, and Dead Poets Society. VOA Hollywood correspondent Mike O'Sullivan spoke with my colleague Victor Beatty about Robin Williams and his work.
Well, you know, he was tremendously talented, and I think that's he was so well respected that I think that explains the great feeling of loss and the fact that people were aware that he had problems with drugs and alcohol, but I don't think people were aware of this severe depression that he apparently has suffered from recently. And his publicist and wife say he's been struggling with very severe depression. But he was such an unusual talent in that he was so quick, he was so bright, he was so good on his feet. Even in that the 1970s sitcom, the situation comedy Mork and Mindy that got him started, he would apparently ad-lib a lot of the scripts. And at first it was frustrating for the producers, but eventually they would just write in, you know, his character was named Mork. He played a space alien. They'd say just let Mork basically do his own thing, and he would just fill it in. And for anybody who had ever seen him on stage, and I haven't seen him live on stage, I've only seen him on television, but he could just take off and do a kind of comic riff that was incredibly sophisticated and clever and funny. And he was just so widely respected by everyone in Hollywood and everyone in the entertainment business that people just feel this is a tremendous loss.
Mike, how will he be best remembered?
Well, he'll be remembered as, as a comic genius, but as a person who was, as a performer who was very versatile. Not only a kind of a slapstick and a kind of intellectual comedy, but a serious actor who could portray, really a range of subtle emotions. And he just seemed so capable, and as a kind of manically entertainment guy, and probably that amassed some problems as we know about his drug and alcohol problems and his psychological problems, but on stage he was just tremendously talented, and on screen, and for the people who knew him, he was very well loved, respected, and loved by what we're hearing, one remembrance after another of people in Hollywood and in the entertainment business. He was just warmly thought of by all the people he worked with.
That is VOA Hollywood correspondent Mike O'Sullivan speaking with my colleague Victor Beatty. Shakespearean actor Charles Keating has died. He was 72. Besides his stage work with the Royal Shakespeare Company and other groups, Keating worked steadily on British and U.S. TV and in the films. His credits included TV's Brideshead Revisited and the movie The Thomas Crown Affair. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Daryl Smith, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Tuesday.
This is Today in History. On August 12th in 30 BC, the Egyptian ruler Cleopatra committed suicide after a military loss in the Battle of Actium, a battle that led to the establishment of the Roman Empire. On August 12th, 1851, American inventor Isaac Singer received a U.S. patent for his sewing machine. Singer made sewing at home easy and affordable. Also on this day in 1898, the Spanish-American War ended when Spain formally agreed to U.S. terms that would cede Guam, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines to American control. Spain also gave up its claims to Cuba. Also in 1898, the United States formally claimed sovereignty over the Hawaiian Islands, which became a U.S. territory 2 years later. On August 12, 1953, the Soviet Union detonated a 400-kiloton thermonuclear bomb in Kazakhstan. It allowed the Soviet Union to essentially pull even with the United States in the nuclear arms race. In 1960, the U.S. Space Agency's first communications satellite, Echo 1, was successfully put into orbit. The Mylar-coated balloon reflected microwave signals back to Earth. In 1973, American golfer Jack Nicklaus won the Professional Golfers Association Championship for his 14th major title. Nicklaus was inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame in 1974 and became PGA Golfer of the Century in 1988. In 1981, IBM released its first personal computer. With 16 kilobytes of memory and a cost of over $1,500, the IBM device became the standard for personal computing. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There is little doubt in the minds of the U.S. military and intelligence community that climate change can accelerate instability and serve as a catalyst for conflict. The National Climate Assessment, released by the White House, noted that the world's climate is already rapidly changing, said Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy and Force Development Daniel Chu before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Certain types of weather events are already occurring more frequently or intensely, including heat waves, heavy downpours, hurricanes, floods, and droughts. Glaciers and Arctic sea ice are melting at a relatively rapid rate, sea levels are rising, and oceans are becoming warmer and more acidic. Moreover, said Assistant Secretary Chu, scientists predict that some of these changes will increase in frequency, duration, and/or intensity over the next 100 years. Already, we see climate change exacerbated drought in the Middle East and Africa, which is contributing to conflicts over food and water. That, in turn, escalates long-standing regional and ethnic tensions, too often resulting in violence. In Asia, rising sea levels are putting at risk people and food supplies in vulnerable coastal regions, such as eastern India, Bangladesh, and much of the Mekong Delta, destroying livelihoods and dislocating residents. Such upheaval contributes to regional and economic instability and could create fertile recruiting ground for extremists. These developments could undermine already fragile governments that are unable to respond effectively or challenge currently stable governments, as well as increasing competition and tension between countries vying for limited resources, said Assistant Secretary Chu. These gaps in governance can create an avenue for extremist ideologies and the conditions that foster terrorism. Indeed, the latest U.S. Defense Department Quadrennial Defense Review, which is issued once every 4 years and is the agency's main public document describing the current doctrine of the United States military, drew a link between the effects of global warming and terrorism. Climate change is an inherently global problem, affecting the security, stability, and economy of all countries. And because the price of doing nothing far outweighs the costs of finding and investing in solutions now, the United States is ready and willing to work closely with all our allies, partners, and other countries across the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.